plants, building or replacing water and sewer lines, and possibly building or closing or adding onto landfills. The program is primarily funded through state monies, but there are some federal grant dollars that are used for smaller communities who apply for grants. For your information, the proposal for the fiscal 2006 budget is a total of $11 million, which would fund approximately 12 grants, $4.4 million in federal funds, and $6.6 million in state funds. In the past couple of fiscal years, in 2005, there were 7 grants for a total of $7 million, and in fiscal 2004, 12 grants that totaled $9 million. As both Ms. Baucus and Mr. Wright referred to, only municipalities are currently eligible under the existing statutory scheme that governs this grant program. And over the last 10 years, 36 local governments have benefited from these grants. There's a local match requirement that's scaled depending on the population of the municipality, and the smaller the community, the less they have to pony up. So it can be 15% up to 50% for a larger municipality. The grants are awarded on a competitive basis, taking into account the public health and environmental impacts of the project, and community capacity, and a few other factors. And it's a pretty typical grant program other than that. There's a 10% holdback. Each grant's audited prior to the release of the final payment, and payments are made on a reimbursable basis to the municipality as the project is brought toward its conclusion. There are 7 positions that currently run this grant program, and there are also those same staff administer 2 low-interest loan programs. The department is strictly speaking, neutral on the legislation before you. It's a policy decision the legislature needs to make, and both the prior speakers brought forward their arguments as to why it might be fair to allow communities that don't have municipal water or sewer utility systems to benefit in the way that the people of Alaska who live in, say, Anchorage, where they have the Anchorage Wastewater and Water Utility, are able to benefit from this grant program. And the department stands ready and able to implement the program however the legislature wants to draw the line for eligibility. The only concern I want to make sure is brought to the members of the committee today is, if the bill were to pass as written, you'll see a fiscal note, I assume was got to you by the third floor, that shows that we would likely have to add a third position. If everyone who could possibly be eligible for the grants under the way the bill is currently written were to take necessary steps to become eligible and then subsequently apply for a grant, it would probably be too much work for the staff that are currently administering the program to meet that need. So it's kind of it's the best case, I guess, if you are looking at getting more grant money out into the hands of local communities that want to improve their water systems. But from the perspective of the department, it would be an untenable situation. And so the fiscal note in front of you addresses that sort of best case / worst case scenario where we would have such an increased level of demand for the grants that we would have to add an additional position. I'm sure it's possible that eligibility for grants can be structured in such a way that the existing staff could meet the demand. And the department stands ready to work with the sponsor and the legislature to make sure that we can provide a more accurate fiscal note if the bill changes in such a way. Other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can answer. I think I would say the same thing that Mr. Wright said, which is that the folks at RCA know a great deal more about it than I do, and they probably can answer more questions than I would be able to.
Questions, Representative Roper, then Guttenberg.
Chairman, do we have Representative from RCA available?
Yeah, Mr. Brown mentioned that, and I don't see that yet.
This is Jim Strandberg, Commissioner with the RCA. I'm available to answer questions.
Okay, I'll hold off on that, Mr. Chairman. I just want to verify that you're available. Also, I would have a question, Mr. Brown, through the chair. Mr. Brown, could you provide myself, the sponsors, and any committee members with a list of the grants and the amounts?
Absolutely.
Was it 3 or 4 years you mentioned?
I don't have the list in front of me, but I'll be happy to get that to you.
Statistics, whatever those.
Yes, yes. All I have that I was able to get staff to provide me were the total amount granted for the past 2 fiscal years and the number of grants. But I don't have a breakdown on the individual grantees.
Could you go back, let's say, 3 years, and then with the individual grantees and the amounts?
Absolutely.
It might help us get an idea of what the geographic dispersion is and how this type of legislation might be able to balance that in terms of equitable distribution.
And the last 3 years suffice, because I can probably go back further.
That's, I'm probably sure.
Okay, yeah, then I'd be happy to make sure that all the committee members get a copy of the individual grant recipients for the last 3 fiscal years and the amount of those grants.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Brown. In the same context, a few years ago, we we allowed, legislation was passed that allowed privately owned water and sewer utilities to get loans. So if we could get a list of who's got a list of number of who's gotten loans before, maybe that would help us anticipate who's going to be applying for grants as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, as it's the same staff that administered both those programs, I don't imagine that would be any additional work for them to prepare a list of the loans over the past few fiscal years as well. So I'll make that part of the same work request, if that's all right.
Great. Any other questions for Mr. Brown? Representative Roker.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Brown, in the fiscal note, it indicates that the analysis of the DEC is that there's 193 water and sewer utilities that would qualify. Do you have a handy list of those that you could provide us later?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roekberg is, that's a good question, and I believe Mr. Strandberg from the Regulatory Commission will be able to speak to that. He and his staff helped provide us with a list of regulated, economically regulated and certificated water utilities and sewer utilities, and so I got the list that number for the fiscal note was based on from him, but I will certainly make sure that I include that in the information that I get to you about grantees and loan recipients.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might,
Okay. You
mentioned if there was a modification of the bill that might affect the fiscal note. Did you have any suggestions to the sponsors? Just a generic statement.
It was a generic statement. As long as we don't have too many people, Mr. Chairman, if I may, as long as we don't have an excessive number of new people applying for the grants, then the fiscal note would probably go down to zero if the existing staff can handle the workload.
Well, because the Finance Committee, where it's going, it probably will anyway. But.
Well, any other questions, Representative Guttenberg?
Just an observation in the same fiscal note, DEC expects to be administering 6 grants each year.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I believe that there is a numerical typographical error in the fiscal note when you look at the number of new grants over the amount of time that's projected, and I apologize for that. I didn't catch that before I sent it to the third floor this morning.
Okay.
So we're probably going to have to do a corrected one as it comes out of this committee anyway.
Okay. Representative Ledoux, then Roekberg.
I just want to clarify something. I'm seeing on page 2 here the private water and sewer utilities economically regulated by RCA, and there are probably not more than 15 or 20 of them, but I've just heard you say that there might be 126 which would qualify?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, it's possible that certificated or even there's the different categories are certificated and non-certificated. A group that is an entity that's not certificated now could become certificated and still not be subject to economic regulation, but it could also request that it be subjected to economic regulation, thereby making itself eligible for this grant program. There would be some hoops to jump through, as I said when I called it a worst case / best case scenario. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just at the end of the day that could be the
total of 126 is the most possible,
right?
Unless someone else incorporates.
Right, right,
festival.
Right. And so they would all have to decide, hey, we want to be economically regulated by the RCA, and presumably the incentive in doing that would be eligibility for these grant funds. There might be some disincentives as well, but that's sort of the angle from which this potential fiscal impact is projected.
Okay, can I follow up?
Sure.
So, in other words, there are private entities out there that are currently not economically regulated by RCA, but are private utility companies, and theoretically, if they wanted to be eligible for this, they could ask to be regulated, to be economically regulated by the RCA. Am I understanding correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, you do understand it correctly, but it's not correct to call them utility companies because they're things like homeowners associations and trailer courts. So they're not in the business of selling a utility service to anyone who wants to buy it. They kind of have a set level of demand, but nevertheless, because they're providing a utility service, they could request of the RCA that they be economically regulated.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jim Strandberg.
Hi, Jim. And by the way, just for the record, Representative Crawford is online. So if you have questions, Representative Crawford, go ahead and ask. Go ahead, Mr. Strandberg.
At some point, I'd be happy to discuss just very shortly about the number of certificated utilities and economically regulated utilities. It might help with the understanding of this particular situation.
Okay, can you hold our questions in and have him do that then?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roper.
Before that, I look forward to his testimony, but I just wanted to comment that Number one, just take note that Mr. Brown has made a transfer from the private sector representing the Chamber of Commerce to the DEC, and I just want to take legislative notice of that shift. And he can give us a report later of how it's working out. It seems it's working okay. One other thing, Mr. Chairman, is I'd like, for the record, I notice the private water and sewer utilities that are currently certified, there's a list in the file. And I just wanted to indicate the Trillium Corporation of Wasilla is a certified sewer utility. And the Trillium Corporation of Wasilla is also a certified water utility. It's associated with the Settlers Bay development, of which my LLC is a customer of Trillium and not a owner of Trillium Corporation. So I don't have a conflict of interest, but I just wanted to put that on the record.
Well, thank you for noting that and your excuse from the meeting.
Oh, good.
Okay, we'll go to Jim Strandberg then, RCA. Jim, welcome, and then also Kara. We know you are standing by. Why don't we go to Jim first so we can answer some of these technical questions, and then you can represent Fairbanks Chamber and give your support. So go ahead, Jim. Why don't you state your name and affiliation for the record, and then you can answer some of those questions.
My name is Jim Strandberg. I'm one of the commissioners at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And I'm very happy to answer questions. If you would like, I could give you like a 5-minute or maybe less just short description of certificated utilities and economically regulated utilities so people understand this situation.
Yeah, just a short description would be fine, and then we'll open it up to questions.
All right. The Regulatory Commission, we're a creature of statute, and in our statute, we are responsible for certificating, that is, providing a certificate of public convenience and necessity for essentially all public utilities which are going to provide water and sewer service to customers in the state of Alaska. The certification process typically we'll take a look at a utility when it's born and as it assembles and make a determination that it's in the public interest that the utility should begin operations. And that universe of utilities is relatively large. The other task that we perform is for a subset of that large group of utilities that we certificate. We will economically regulate them, and what that means is that they submit cost information to us, and we will set a rate that they can charge for providing the water and sewer service. So what's important is that this bill talks about any utility that's economically regulated by the Regulatory Commission would be eligible for these grants. And, in that Q&A, I can go perhaps further into the particular circumstance we're looking at, but suffice it to say we have a relatively large number of utilities that we certificate, but we economically regulate only a small number of the utilities in the state. Partially because the municipalities that are exempt from our economic regulation, and the concept there is that because they are self-governed, the ratepayers in the municipalities don't need the protections of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We economically regulate only where the water company serves as a monopoly, and that it has the ability to really raise prices at will. And under those circumstances, we will go in and basically set a reasonable rate. So that's the fundamental concept about how the RCA is operating. Mr. Brown spoke of a number of numbers. I'll tell you that I think in his fiscal note, he had 193 utilities, which are essentially non-municipal utilities which could conceivably be eligible for these grants. The question, true question, is how many of them would actually come in for those grants? Mr. Chairman, I think that is just a short discussion of what it is that we do, and it focuses on the issue. I would note that our fiscal note, we have a zero fiscal note on this, mainly because we believe that for a number of reasons that many of these utilities may come under economic regulation at a later date, and that is currently within our funding.
Thanks, Jim. Are there any questions for Mr. Strandberg from the RCA? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Strandberg, on the second page of your fiscal fiscal note, which is stapled to the DEC fiscal note in my page, in case anybody's wondering, you talk about reduced regulatory reform programs for small water and sewer, but that when that's implemented, people applying for this, so utilities applying for this program might want to be regulated at a higher level. Can you talk about that? What's happening with the reduction of reduced regulatory program and the one that people who want this grant are going to come in are going to be required to fulfill?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Guttenberg, for the question. We have been working for a number of years on this particular part of our operation. It began in basically, I think, the year 2000 when we had a ledge audit action item requiring us to be more active with water and sewer utilities. Since that time, we have provided alternative certification programs for small water and sewer utilities, and we are actively bringing more utilities under this provisional certification program. In addition, we have an open regulations docket and a active stakeholder working group to change the way that we economically regulate small utilities to make it more affordable and more effective. And this program we're pursuing. There are a number of participants in the stakeholder group. The federal funders who are also have an interest in establishing sustainable utility service within Alaska are also participating in that process.
Follow up?
Yeah, what, Mr. Strandberg, thank you. What is the breakoff point for this that you're going to separate small versus, versus large, the regulatory breaking point?
Through the chair, a very good question, Representative Berg. That is to be determined. Our regulations process currently, we've assembled a group of stakeholders and the actual people that would be under this regulation, and we are awaiting their analysis of that and their recommendation to us.
Any other questions? Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Strandberg, along the line of Representative Guttenberg's questioning.
Guttenberg.
I'm sorry. Why do I do that? How many years do I have? Representative Guttenberg's questioning. So when you reach the end of this process, you'll have a different method of regulating small utilities. But they still would be regulated and therefore would qualify, I would presume, under this bill. But then it would be less of a burden for you to manage. Is that your objective going back 4 years and trying to downsize? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Rookberg, that's exactly our objective here. Before, we've had basically the same size sock for all the feet, and we're going to create different size socks here. And our goal is to lessen the costs of regulation and to make it more effective. And I would say that my current feeling is that whatever the rule that we come up with under this program will represent full economic regulation, but it will just be a different set of rules that are configured for smaller utilities.
I might follow up. Is the figure 193 accurate? And does that include all the A, B, and C class water utilities in the state?
Through the chairman, Representative Rookberg, Thank you for that question. We've spent a fair amount of time on that. I would ask your indulgence. We may have a minor difference in numbers with what we gave to DEC. It may be more like 188, but we have carefully looked at our records, and those include all homeowners associations, all privately owned utilities, all mobile home communities, and all nonprofit cooperatives.
I got a bunch in my district, but
that's a good question to have on our.
Yeah, that's very important. I appreciate that.
Yes.
And because right now you on the A, B, and C classes, which of those do you currently regulate? Just A and B, or do I have another way around?
We regulate the definition of the public utility is included in our statute, and it basically includes any utility that's providing service to 10 or more customers for compensation.
Mr. Chairman, don't you have the three different categories of the water utilities, though, or isn't, am I not remembering something correctly? Or?
Well, actually, the DEC has the Class A, B, and C water systems, and that has to do with their level of vigilance on the water quality and treatment. We have a different set of definitions that we work under.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify then, so it's the 10 or more that are regulated by the RCA, and you make no further distinction this time, and it's the DEC that has the other alphabetized classification. Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Roepberg, that is correct, sir.
Follow up?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to get. Are there do private utilities, do you currently regulate them if they're monopolies in certain jurisdictions?
Through the chairman, that is correct.
But not the munis. Okay, that's okay.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Not the munis.
Keith, no other questions? Thank you, Jim, for your testimony. And stand by in case we have any more questions. I'll ultimately close public testimony today, and we can pass this bill out and the supplemental information from Mr. Brown we can have distributed next week and as it goes on through finance. I don't think that information would bear on people's decision to support the bill to move on or not. It looks like...
Mr. Chairman, I did have another question, Mr. Strandberg.
Okay.
Forgive me. I hate to do this, but... through the chair, Mr. Strandberg.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us how the RCA handles a grant? If, in fact, you'd have a regulated utility receive one of these grants, how does that affect their rate base, and is that included in your computation for the rate setting that you do? In other words, would these taxpayers be subsidizing a private utility by giving them a grant, and then, and ultimately, the RCA, how do they handle that grant when they do set the tariffs?
Through the chair, another very good question, Representative Roepberg. We have regulatory tools, and the short answer is we have the ability to not allow a privately owned utility to enrich its shareholders from the provision of a grant, of an infrastructure grant like this. And with your concurrence, I'd take maybe 30 seconds more and just explain that we have what's called contributions in aid of construction. Oftentimes we can, a utility will request the homeowner to provide some money for extensions, and that money is thrown in the pot. It goes into building the infrastructure, but the utility is not allowed to depreciate that, and the utility cannot, through its rates, have the customer pay back that money, that contribution, nor can the utility earn a return on that. And these grants are essentially the same as contributions in aid of construction. We have tools available to appropriately treat these in the public interest.
Thank you. Good. I think good questions. Thank you, Jim. We'll next go to Kara Moriarty in Fairbanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the president of the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, and on behalf of our 750 members, I would like to speak in support of House Bill 46. As you can see in your packets, you have a resolution from 2003 that was the prior bill that was filed in the previous legislative session, and we did support the concept that all utilities should be on the same playing field then, and we still support that concept today. Currently, the only utilities that are eligible for these grants, as been stated, are publicly owned utilities, and the grants are primarily used for infrastructure development and upgrades. As has been shared by previous folks that have testified today, based on the regulations set by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the shareholders in privately owned utilities cannot generate a return on investment or receive depreciation expense credits for any grant funds they receive. Because of these regulations, the only beneficiaries then, if a privately owned utility were to receive grants, would be the ratepayers or the citizens, basically the citizens of a community. As you may know, all utilities in Fairbanks are either owned privately or by a cooperative. So in essence, Fairbanks businesses and residents are at a disadvantage compared to other Alaskan residents. One of the first questions we often field from prospective businesses that want to locate to Fairbanks or even expand in our community is, what is the cost of doing business? And utility costs are certainly a major component of a business operating cost. Infrastructure needs for some of our utilities in our community are great. In fact, it is not uncommon for a business that wants to locate in what would seem like close proximity to downtown Fairbanks to not be able to connect to our major utility lines. And this often hampers our economic development efforts. Because the costs of infrastructure expansion are so large, and in an effort to keep rates at a reasonable level, it is a challenge for our utilities to expand and upgrade infrastructure without passing those costs on to us, the ratepayers. Not only would these grants enable our utilities to receive them for infrastructure needs, as the infrastructure expands, more people pay into the system, thus making our utility costs more economical for everyone. So, on behalf of Fairbanks businesses and residents, I would urge this committee to look at this bill as a fairness issue. It's only fair that our privately owned utilities should be eligible like other utilities across the state to receive these grants. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thanks for waiting and testifying. Any other individuals? I see Dan Guevara. I think you were just answer only. Is that okay, Dan, or do you have testimony?
No, I was answer only. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify in the audience? Online? Okay, then I'll close public testimony. Is there any discussion from the committee? Pro, con? If not, can I have a motion to move the bill out of committee? We'll have the supplemental information from Mr. Brown forthcoming, and the bill will then move on to Finance Committee where they can address the fiscal nature and elements of the bill again. Representative Roper?
Could I ask Mr. Brown to provide a small, brief description of the grant program itself for the file? I don't think there's one in there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I'll make sure that all the members have that.
Sounds good. Get a motion to Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 46. I believe we don't have no amendments with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, so moved. Please sign the file so we can move it on to Finance Committee. Thanks to everyone for standing by, testifying, and thanks for people waiting for the next bill. We'll get to that now. And incidentally, House Bill 35, extending the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Surveyors by Representative Coring, was requested by Representative Coring to be postponed. So that's why that's not on the docket today. So now we have House Bill 81 back before us, the Contractor License Enforcement Bill.
We had some questions and concerns, and I think one of the biggest issues had to do with home inspector calling from Wasilla and asking for some deletions in the bill, which subsequently would have been extrapolated out in Forest Legal Services to take out all references in the statute to home inspectors. And I think we're not going to do that because of that difficulty, including a title change with that. And I think the other question is addressed, and I didn't want to have to put Mr. Bitney on the hot seat here, but we have an amendment, actually a CS, which are the changes that you've wanted. Do you want to go through those, and then we can get to questions? I kept public testimony open, if you don't mind. I have a general understanding of it, but it might be better you succinctly going through it, and then we can have last-minute questions on this and see if we've kind of quelled any anxiety that came from the last meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I apologize for my voice here today. My name is John Bitney. I'm under contract and registered as a lobbyist for the Alaska State Home Builders Association. You gave a correct description. I would just like to add to your comments on the home inspector issue for just a second, Mr. Chairman, and let you know that I did speak directly with Mr. Owen, who was the testifier. He was also a member of the State Home Builders Board, and he understands the situation with legal services, and I've provided him that information. In addition, there was also, of course, incorporated in here the conceptual amendment that the committee passed that was requested by the Department of Labor in regards to more clearly defining the administrative hearing process. The amendment that you're referring to, Mr. Chairman, is at the top of page 5, starting on line 2. And this was in response to testimony from two of the people who were here. One was Mr. Owens, who also addressed this issue, and also it was also testified to by Alan Wilson, who's the co-chair of the legislative committee, who's also sitting here in the audience. And this relates to the exemption that's in current state law for owner builders to build their own home. And as you can see from the existing language, it is a very broad exemption. It is exempting anyone who builds a single family, duplex, triplex, fourplex, or commercial building every year. And 1 year is ill-defined. The enforcement of that is very difficult. And the testimony was is that you have family who are in, if you will, running a general contracting business, who each member of the family will build one of these dwellings each year. So as you can see, they're doing significant volume through this loophole, which I think violates the intent of the law, which was the legislature's interested, of course, if you're a homeowner interested in building your own home, it's not to stop you or somehow force you to become registered as a contractor. So the language,
point, just so for clarification, so the committee members know, your point is someone has five children, adults who build homes, and each of them could work. This might be an anomaly, but it's possible each builds a home, and that's six homes a year, and then they're able to go under that requirement just because of the nature that he had a lot of kids and they all wanted to build homes.
Mr. Chairman, that is absolutely correct. In the testimony that we had, was that is indeed situations that we are seeing now, or that is happening. I live in the Mat-Su area in Palmer. I'm personally familiar with people who do things very similar to that. They're doing four or five dwellings a year per each member of the family. Essentially, they're running a very substantial general contracting business with no registration with the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
I move we adopt the committee substitute House Bill 181, 24LS0144/Y, Michelle 12605.
Hearing no objection, so adopted for discussion purposes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, that's it. Would it help, we have a few minutes, if really briefly Mr. Bitney just gave a synopsis in a sentence or two of each section? We can just go through it. Could we do that of this? Just because Representative Cott wasn't here, Representative Roper wasn't here, and Representative Crawford, I don't think, was online. I don't want to get into too much minutia because that's their responsibility to read it in advance. But the idea is, and you can help me, but with Section 1, That's just the implementation of the citation, which before didn't exist, correct?
Mr. Chairman, in Section 1, this is the current enforcement statute where the citation, if you will, of someone acting in this capacity has to go to the Department of Law, be prosecuted. So what we're saying here is accept as provided,
yep.
Which then gets us to the heart of the bill, which is Section 2.
And that's where the fines come in for a first and second and continued violations.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Section 2 is the heart of the bill as it's as the intent. It speaks for itself, and I think that everybody's familiar with what we're trying to do.
$1,000 and the $1,500 fine, which has been raised. And then Section 3?
Section 3 takes the existing penalty and raises it up so it's equal to the minimum for what? For the new penalty phase that we're adding.
Okay. And Section 4 defines the violation parameter?
That's correct. This cleans up the existing statute to make sure that the reference to the new enforcement action is included.
Section 5 exemptions
is the long list of exemptions, and so we get all the way to the top of page 5 there where the language is that we just discussed.
And that's, again, where owner must, after they build the home, if it's for their home and they don't have to get a contracting license, then they must live there for 3 consecutive years.
That is correct, Mr.
Chairman.
Which
signifies it's the home for themselves.
Thank you.
And then Section 6.
Section 6 is a conforming section. I may need some help to if you have details. I know
no,
this.
No, I don't. Just for statutory conforming and parallel to the other references, which we find in a lot of bills, and I don't think that one.
Section.
I wanted to make sure people understood that weren't here. The legislators were the fees and that structure, so they understand what we're changing.
Section 7 and 8 are sort of transitional sections that make sure that this is not a retroactive. It's not our, we're not seeking to go back and get anybody. These were added in by the drafter to clarify the bill. I can't speak to them, but I think I'd.
No, that's sufficient. Now, with Mr. Bitney representing the State Home Builders Association, having represented and talked about the CS, which we've adopted before us, I know that there are gentlemen here as needed from those various organizations, as well as Greg Mitchell from Labor and Workforce Development, that department. I also see that Dave Owens is here, about the only individual that is asked to testify. I didn't close public testimony last meeting. I still haven't remained open, is Mr. Owens. Mr. Owens, did you hear what Mr. Bitney stated regarding your question, and is that resolved?
I was sorry I'm a little bit late today, Mr. Chairman, but I did catch a good percentage of what Mr. Bitney says, and I am in very much support of this bill and do agree with what he said in regards to the owner builders.
Okay, and that's Dave Owens with the Mat-Su Home Builders
Association. Yes, sir.
And a home inspector in the valley, in the Mat-Su Valley. Good. Then if there is no one else to testify, I'll close public testimony. We can certainly ask questions of Mr. Bitney or the home builder representatives here. Are there any more questions? And I think with the information given, hopefully the members understand. Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you. We had a conversation, Mr. Chairman, where most business gets done in this building that's on the stairwell. But the question I asked and I was concerned about is there anywhere a quantitative number of fines that have happened about this, or consumer complaints? Is there, I mean, we've heard from the industry about the issue and how important it is. But is there, have we seen a quantitative number? How problematic it is, number of houses that have been built that, outside of violations, or just something that that shows us it's really a problem.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Gray Mitchell. I'm Director of Labor Standards and Safety. That's okay.
I'm in.
In Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We do have quite a number of violations each year that we track. It runs anywhere from 130 to 150. This year we've got about 85 so far in the fiscal year.
And just for edification for the committee in record, you mean that it may not be necessarily the scenario of a father with 5 boys building homes, but you mean people that are not licensed, that are operating in this bill, hence your support fixes that with a penalty.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain to the committee what the current sanction is available to you now and why, you know, it's related to this bill? I mean,
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, the current penalty is a criminal penalty, a misdemeanor, and so we're basically required to take that case to the district attorney and pursue criminal charges, which is somewhat problematic and time-consuming, and because these are low-level violations in the district attorney's mind, it's difficult to pursue the cases that way.
Presumably, Mr. Chairman, it's a Class B misdemeanor is contained in this bill, or?
That's correct. I think the current criminal citation is actually listed in Section 4 of the bill as it is in statute right now.
So the current sanction is a Class B misdemeanor.
That's correct.
So if I might, Mr. Chairman,
sure.
As the bill sponsor, it's the idea here is to add the civil penalties and administrative fines to give other tools rather than have a criminal prosecution. Is that
correctly? Correctly stated.
So this guy better watch out, because you can nail him with an injunction, get a civil penalty, administratively fine him, and then give him a Class B misdemeanor case. So he can get whacked about three different ways there. We got a conflict of laws here. Maybe Dr. LeDoux can give us some help with that.
By the way, for the record, Representative Cott was here, and that was my mistake. I was thinking of a different bill, and he did hear this, but at least, were you here, Representative Roper?
No,
okay. I was by Dennis.
No, and I just, so at least maybe this gives you a perspective, because you probably have the most expertise. Representative Cott?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if Representative Roper is correct, we got slight problem if we can charge somebody with a misdemeanor and also fine them civilly. I'm not sure there may not be a conflict, but I guess
I'm kind of concerned about that.
The real question I have, I guess, can you give me a scenario where a violation would be detected and no fine imposed? Because clearly this is very, the operative word is may. So you don't have to give a fine, and we don't even know what the fine might be. It could be $1 up to $1,000. I mean, so there's a lot of wiggle room here, if you will, and I'm not sure, depending on how it is implemented, that we get to where we want to get in a way we want to get there. But can you maybe just comment on maybe detecting a violation in which there would be no citation issued?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Cott, maybe a situation where you caught someone whose license had expired and you'd issue them a civil fine and they came in and, you know, showed that they had gotten right and, you know, reinstated their bonding and licensing. We're not going to pursue a fine in that kind of circumstance.
Okay. So you can be guilty in violation. Okay.
Is that good enough, or do you want an example of non-lapse?
That's good old Spinard justice. You know, just doing the right thing. You know.
Representative LeDoux?
No, we do the right thing by determining the level of the fine. Maybe we just charge them $10. You know, we give them a $500 fine. Oh, you let your license expire, and you got it renewed since, and we're fine. Reduce it to $10, and no slap on him because you're still guilty of operating without a license. I mean, that's, you know, it's still a problem out there.
Well,
we don't know. We don't know. He meant that person's intent may have been felonious anyways. Maybe he wasn't going to renew it, but since he got caught, I got to go right to it now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there may be an epidemic of this going on. If you get caught doing something, then you just get a slap in the hand. I mean, maybe the trend, current trend.
Well, that's always the dilemma, and you can make an analogy with anything, with a speeding ticket. No. Going 60. Do you get pulled over going 66 on the Glen Highway? Often not. Do you get a hefty fine if you inadvertently missed the reapplication date, or if you maliciously did it? I think these are things that you probably have to weigh, and I would assume act accordingly and regulatorily or in terms of the adjudication process, we really don't have purview over that other than on a periphery basis. So that's probably up to you, and I don't think we can legislate how you do that. Because there's so many scenarios where someone might violate. Representative Ledoux, did you have a question?
Yes, I do, and this involves Section 5, the exemptions. How was the figure on Exemption 12, the owner-occupier, how was the figure 3 years determined?
That would be a representative from the homebuilders, Mr. Bitney, or one of the contractors might?
Mr. Chairman, John Bitney, again. In discussions, the idea was to try to get sort of, if you will, a bright line out there for enforcement. We talked at least a minimum of two, no more than three, if you will, I think is a sufficient time. So this was sort of the maximum sort of a thing that we felt was sort of getting at what we were trying to accomplish here with this. The idea was is that it needed to be more than 1 year on an occupancy so that the department has they're better able to determine that it truly is an owner builder situation where the person is building it to live in it, which I think is gets more at what the intent of the exemption is.
And so for clarification, if it were let's say a year, then you could have a home owner, alleged homeowner, building one every other year, and still, you understand, if it's $1 million home, then...
Absolutely. But I guess I'm thinking in terms of when would enforcement action take place? A person builds a home, and then 2 years later, for example, he sells the home. Would the department then get involved in?
And wouldn't you say, Mr. mm-hmm. Bitney, that would be only if someone were to detect that? Can we talked about that last time, or were any of right. these agencies or divisions we deal with as legislators? The 66-mile-an-hour example, I mean, you can't always catch unless there's sight being seen. So those are difficult to catch.
And Mr. Chair, my understanding of the applicability here, it goes to when you would start acting as a general contractor for the construction on the next new home.
But Representative Ledoux is asking, I think, aren't you saying what would happen if someone sold 2 years in?
That's right.
They're supposed to stay for three. Now they've violated the law that we've just changed. That's I suppose they would
again,
have
Mr.
to
Again, Mr. Chairman, the applicability is not so much when you sell the home that you built as to when you would start the construction. On the next home is the intent here.
And so if someone built their own home and diverted from having to get the license, contracting license that we're proposing here, and they sold it within a year, then they would be in violation. But it may not be detected unless someone again informed the department.
That's correct.
Obviously.
Can I just follow
sure.
up here? But if the test is when you then start the next home, wouldn't that be taken care of in the last clause of that, of the exemption? The owner shall be limited to construction of one home, duplex, triplex, etc., per year. Which is without the new language.
I don't follow you. So you're thinking that there could be multiple buildings constructed, or you think there could be less than 3 year build and residences? I don't follow.
I think I'm going to take back my question because I think this doesn't apply.
I was waiting for you to say, why isn't sixplex in the list?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Kodiak's question is germane in terms of the slight ambiguity this is created by asserting this clause in here, because we have a 3-year standard now by adopting the CS, but we still retain a 1-year standard within the same sentence, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, within the same sentence, we have two different tests. So it could lend itself to some ambiguity in interpretation.
So, and so the recommendation might be to somehow tweak page 5, line 6, so that it's in parity with page 5, beginning of section 12, line 2, and 3, line, it would be 3 years.
Right, if you want a bright line test, let's not make it ambiguous. But it's a matter of drafting here, I think. Unless the sponsor, you were trying to allow the, for example, building a single family residence and a commercial building, of which you could legitimately occupy both concurrently. But as Representative Ledoux points out, what happens after if you alienate the property after 2 years?
What do you think, Mr. Brittany? Yeah, and this is a good question. We want it to be a clean, we don't want to deal with this in the next committee or on the floor.
I'm sitting here saying, you know, well, you can interpret this. It's like a lawyer's dream here. You know?
So explain where, with this ambiguity, what you think, an example of what could happen that we don't intend. So everyone on the committee understands. I think I follow you.
Well, you can occupy it. You build something and you occupy it, but then you can build something else. Then the I'm trying to think.
Like
the,
a commercial
family building. Member could rent one of the apartments in a duplex or something. I don't know. I mean, but then you could have a commercial building. But then by this might be considered a constraint on trade if you disallow the sale of a property. You know, there might be a compelling state interest to restrain that because of you're trying to avoid somebody from not being licensed when they should be. So I mean, but.
And Mr. Brittany, that's the only difficulty that I might have just tied in with that is that the idea that you have a commercial building versus a home. And so how do we reconcile that so that
occupy a home, I mean a commercial building, I mean, and a home concurrently. I that's not a problem, but you have to occupy it for your business or you have some external evidence of occupancy.
So is there, do you think there is a way we can somewhat reconcile the, I suppose there is ambiguity if you look at it line by line because of the fact that we have the 3-year requirement on one hand.
You could make it one, you could only build one every 3 years.
Every 3 years.
Yeah.
Only one every 3 years.
That's consistent, then, but then you're setting that standard. But
do you want to make that conceptual amendment then?
It's your bill.
I'm asking you. Your endorsement is appreciated.
Well, I'd like clarity. But, you know, okay. Is that the right standard?
Then that'll be a conceptual amendment that in this subsection 12, page 5, line 2 through 7, we have legislative legal services clean that up.
Mr. Chairman, so moved by myself to assist you in having that conceptually, so let the drafter clean it up.
Okay. And I think that's the only spot in the bill that we're referencing that Representative Guttenberg.
Same place, same paragraph, 3 consecutive years. Could that be 14 months? Is that three consecutive calendar years, or you want it to be 36 months?
John's like, why did I come to work today? Mr. Vitney, what do you think?
Well, I think either way is it's saying the same thing, but I think.
We'll have legal services look at that tied in with conceptual amendment number one.
I understand that.
Normally, we don't list out the months, but I understand your. Maybe there's a interpretation ambiguity. I'm not sure. If that's okay, we'll rely on them.
Yeah, I mean, if legal says 3 consecutive years, being said, you know, probably at some point of a year, it's considered a year.
Sure.
Right.
Maybe December to January the following year.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper?
On this point now, if we're clarifying to say 3 consecutive years and you're disallowed for 3 years for these construction, is there, should we put something on the record? Is there a rationale about why 3 years was chosen versus 2 years now if we're going to tighten this up even further? Or? Is there a reason for that we can justify?
I think the legislative intent, if someone were to look back at the record due to a court case, would be that we're discouraging, as noted earlier, builders who are trying to get under this requirement by holding themselves out as simply a home builder from building multiple homes, let's say over a decade period, and not living in them, and instead, in this case, with having children that maybe are competent in building, having a multitude of homes being built and money being generated from that, and not actually living and residing in the homes. And so I think 3 years isn't scientifically determined, but it's long enough where it would appear someone is making a building the home for residential purposes. I think any amount farther than would be maybe punitive for them to build their own home and not have the contract. For instance, if that were me, then I would just buy the contract so I can move out within a couple of years and not be forced to live there. But is that right, Mr. Brittany, that 3 years seems a fair?
Mr. Chairman, and yes, the three years and the discussion was much about what you're discussing now is to make sure that the department who's faced with enforcing this isn't in a situation where does the year begin? Did it begin at when the spade got first turned on the first shovel full of dirt? So that's why we went to occupancy, was hopefully to give it a brighter line, and also such that someone couldn't make the case that they finished it in the fall, moved in it, lived in it in the winter, and then sold it in the spring. That this clearly, I think, trying to get at the intent here.
Set a base amount of time. Representative Ledoux.
Let's assume that someone built their own home, sold it 2 years later, and then didn't build another house, either bought another house, moved someplace else. Would they be at all liable under this new paragraph?
The owner must occupy for 3 years, as we've amended, three consecutive years, 36 months. So once completion of construction is finalized, they must move in and they must occupy it for 3 years, or they have violated the contractor licensure statute and perhaps would be forced to get a contracting license or pay a fine and both.
That's right, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that this gets at to whether or not they would then be qualified to start construction, when they would be qualified to start construction on the next home under the exemption.
Which I think is an excellent idea. What I'm concerned about is somebody builds a house. I mean, and they're not in the house building field, but they're building their own home. And then for some reason or another, illness, death in the family, they've changed their job, they simply move someplace else. Theoretically, I think under the way this is worded now, they're in violation of the law.
So your point is they can't even begin construction, fearing that if they finish in a year and they're residing per the statute 3 years in the other residence, they're not going to be able to move, and they're completed construction, so they're in violation of that next building. I mean, this would be a rare case.
I guess I'm not worried that they're not going to start construction because of that, but that things happen. Could they possibly be prosecuted if...
Mr. Brittany?
I'm
going to have my staff pass on aspirin.
Yeah.
No.
Representative,
no,
I think
the intent of this legislation is not to stop the homeowner builder who does one every 4 or 5 years and moves on, but the person that's trying to stay under the radar, and if we just have to put that on, on the record as legislative intent, then maybe that's the point.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
That's the type of thing I was looking at in terms of the actual drafting. I mean, if we can set the policies, we want to avoid that, but we could use the style of the standard to be such that we want to prohibit this type of activity, and the test could be if whether or not you're a bona fide occupant. That way you could, if you, for example, if I have a family residency and I adopt some twins after a year, and want to build a new house, or I have to get transferred from Palmer to Kenai and want to build my own house, we shouldn't restrict that statutorily. But it's got to be a bona fide owner-occupant.
And so using that example, under this legislative intent, formalizing Representative Ledoux, if someone has built a home, again, under the radar, they don't have to get the contractor's license, bona fide person just building a home to live in, and during that time, this analogy, twins are born and they want to construct another home, they must live in the first residence home 3 years, no matter when the construction of the new home is. As long as they live in 3 years, then they can move to the next, if that unique example were to occur. And I don't think they would be in violation for the second. And that's not our intent, and certainly not mine, if that were to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different, it's a change of the style with how to implement it. It becomes a little more difficult to draft, I think. But, I mean, we could even talk about restricting family members, if you will, because that was one of the examples where there were violations here, that you'd have various family members be the principal. So you could have some type of a statutory definition that prohibited the various family members from qualifying under the single exception rule. And, you know, so that there's different drafting styles.
No, I'm pausing because I'm not sure, I don't know if I want to delay for another week or if we can do this in a conceptual amendment, but the original conceptual amendment number one cleaned up subsection 12 on page 5. I like what you just said, making it more definitive in terms of the differences if you have children or others, family members building, but that expands the bill in conceptual amendment number one enough where I'm hesitant to just move the bill on.
What other referrals do you have?
And hoping for the best. So,
judicial?
Yeah. I think that we can move it on.
If you want to do that, and then we can move it out and you can fix it in judicial.
And I will alert them if the committee is so willing to move this out to prepare to maybe assess that judicial legal parameter. And by then, this conceptual amendment will have been inserted in, and at least there'll be parity in the 3 years. So why don't we do that? The conceptual amendment number one has been adopted. They'll clean up, legal services will clean up the three-year aspect. We have on record legislative intent. If judiciary, which I'm vice chairman of, we can perhaps clean it up even more. Are there any other questions of Mr. Bitney?
Chairman, excuse me, I'm not sure yet we're giving the drafter enough flexibility with the motion that was made previously.
Okay, do you want to
recast the, Mr. Chairman, I could withdraw, ask that we withdraw conceptual amendment number one.
Okay.
Without objection.
Okay, without objection. So conceptual amendment number one is withdrawn?
Conceptual amendment number two, which okay. The instructions of the drafter are to make the numbers of building units consistent with the any length of prohibition, and additionally consider not necessarily to prohibit the construction if it's for bona fide, if the person who builds the unit, be it residential, commercial, is a bona fide user of it, there wouldn't be a 3-year restriction. We can't restrict the alienation or movement or mobility of people. We need another criteria, which is a bona fide residency, and perhaps the restriction of numbers of people within a family that would qualify as the sideboards. If that's confusing enough. To the committee staff.
Well, I have two of them here, so they're jotting down notes, and they can work with legal services. Mr. Bitney, do you have a response to that conceptual
Mr.
amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would just suggest perhaps that I think that the bold underlying text might be better constructed, if you will, in the limitation on line 6 rather than at the start of the entire
So page 5, exemption. Lines 2 and 3, which are bold, stating occupies the property after construction for not less than 3 consecutive years end. That's bold and underlined. You're saying reformat that into the same paragraph, but page 5, line 6, after limited and legal services
as
can work.
As been conceptually discussed here. Right. I think that that, I think that working it in.
We still have a problem with the 3 years. I think you got, yes. You're running into a problem with that as a bright line. You got to have.
Well, we'll have legal services look at that. Conceptual amendment number 2, it doesn't sound like there's objections. I know that's the intent of the committee to have that read well. And then what we will do is we will get a copy to all the committee members. It'll move on to judiciary. And then if you have further concerns, you can certainly attend or give your input at that level. And then it'll move on. The bill moves on.
We trust you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll work it. So good. Then that bill, why don't I have a motion to move the bill out of committee? My dear friend and rules chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move between substitute for House Bill 81 as amended with individual recommendations in the attached zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objections, so moved on to House Judiciary. Again, Friday's meeting has been canceled, and that was the meeting that we were going to hear the dentist regulation bill, and we will have our normal scheduled meeting Monday, January 31st at 3:15, and look forward to seeing you there. And we will adjourn at 4:40. Thank you.
Well, sorry, Charlie.
Sorry.